a baseball game, a day in a park with friends and family, fishing in a remote stream, work, travels, providing for loved ones, or heading out for adventures. Whatever you do, whatever you enjoy, you need your health. The original Guide to Men's Health is presented by the Washington State Urology Society to help take you through the steps necessary to get the most out of life. If you have invested in a retirement plan for your future, why not invest in your body? After all, it makes better sense to retire healthy and enjoy your future. These podcasts are a guide for how to take care of yourself. If you take care of your car and maintain it, why not do the same for your personal machine, your body? If you know you should but haven't yet, the information in these podcasts contains some easy recommendations for where, when, and how to get started. Follow the podcast as we explore men's health with renowned experts and embark on a journey towards better health. Your heart beats for you, so learn how to keep the beat for your heart. What you need to know about cardiovascular disease to keep your heart beating and avoid the risk of stroke and heart attack. Today we review heart health and related topics with cardiologist Eugene Yang. On this episode of the original Guide to Men's Health, it's my pleasure to interview Dr. Eugene Yang. Dr. Yang is a clinical associate professor of medicine, Division of Cardiology, the University of Washington School of Medicine. He acts as the medical director for the Eastside Specialty Center and is a governor of the Washington chapter of the American College of Cardiology. He also serves as director of the Cardiovascular Wellness and Prevention Clinic at the University of Washington. And what better way to start a discussion about cardiovascular health than prevention? So, Dr. Yang, I'm your typical young guy at 30, and I come in, and what do I have to be worried about, and how would you tell me to look after myself as far as cardiovascular health?
Dr. Pellman, thank you very much for inviting me to speak today about this very important topic. I think as men in general, we tend to be less aware of our health and do not pay as much attention as we should. As a cardiologist and specifically as a preventative cardiologist, the goals for somebody who is young is to try to make lifestyle changes and behavioral modifications when we're younger so that we don't end up developing problems associated with our heart later on in life. Specifically, the things that we can focus on that are going to have a very positive effect on our health are to be screened for the things that are risk factors for heart disease. The major risk factors for heart disease are high blood pressure. Seeing your primary care provider to measure your blood pressure is important. Secondly, a baseline level of your cholesterol is also important, as some people may have very high cholesterol levels because of a genetic disorder, and those individuals need to be treated at a very early age. Additional tests that should be done include screening for diabetes if you are overweight, and other things that we need to focus on include things that we can control. So tobacco use is a leading cause of cardiac disease. So if you're smoking, that's something that needs to be addressed. And then the things that are probably most important are really around diet and exercise. So diet is an intervention that needs to be made early on to optimize what we're taking in our bodies. And those things have long-term consequences on our risk of developing heart disease, oftentimes impacted by the development of high blood pressure or elevated cholesterol and diabetes that are the result of poor diet. Finally, exercise is probably the most important thing. So when we look at the benefits of all of the things that we do in cardiology, for example, trying to lower blood pressure, improving diabetes, treating cholesterol. The biggest impact that we see in reducing the risk of developing heart disease is exercise. So at least 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity exercise is probably the most important thing that we can do to improve our cardiovascular health.
So I have a young man who comes in at 30, as I said, for a vasectomy consult. And in talking to him, he tells me that both his parents in their 50s had cardiac events. So, you know, he's otherwise healthy, has no primary care doctor. He is somebody who's maybe even a little late in getting in to see you because he's got a family history of significance.
Right. So that's, I would say, somebody who is in a slightly different category. So we do get a little bit more concerned, and our awareness is definitely sensitized for individuals who have a family history of early heart disease. So how we define that is if you have a first-degree relative, a male relative who is younger than 55 when they have a heart attack or a cardiovascular procedure, or a female relative who is less than 65 years of age, those are warning signs that there may be some genetic or hereditary predisposition. So those individuals definitely should be evaluated and screened by a provider for the risk factors that we talked about.
So looking at the patient who is young, hasn't been exercising, but in their 30s, what would you tell them to do as far as how much exercise?
Great. So, you know, we have had many studies that have examined, you know, what are the thresholds where people derive a cardiovascular benefit to exercise. And we always seem to come back to about the same sort of threshold, which is about 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity exercise. So what does moderate intensity exercise include? So that includes things such as swimming, playing doubles tennis, walking briskly at about a 3.5 mile per hour pace. So those are all considered moderate intensity activities. So if you choose to do those types of activities, then you need to achieve about 150 minutes a week or more. If you do high intensity activities, then you don't need to do as much exercise. So if you play basketball on the weekends, that's considered a high intensity activity. Or singles tennis is also a high intensity activity. So in those cases, you want to achieve at least a minimum of 75 minutes a week.
So let's move to the other end of the age spectrum, a close to 70-year-old who hasn't been exercising for decades, who is now in your office. He's had some warning signs. His primary care physician said, I want you to see cardiology. How would you tell this gentleman to start exercising?
So that's a very different scenario because in a patient who is 70, many of them have established risk factors. And so if they're individuals who have not been active, then consulting with your primary care provider or a cardiologist is important to make sure that it's safe for you to engage in an exercise program. So currently, if I have somebody who has not been very active and who has risk factors such as high blood pressure or high cholesterol or diabetes, then we often will do some sort of screening stress test on these individuals to ensure that it's safe for them to do that before we allow them to initiate a more vigorous exercise program. But the same rules apply whether you're 30 or 70, which is that the target in terms of the amount of exercise that we want to see people achieve is the same. But in the case of somebody who is 70, consulting with your provider or your cardiologist to make sure it's safe for you to do that is important.
So in the realm of exercise, I do want to throw in that we have a lot of evidence that not only cardiac rate and the ability to exercise and sweat, but do some musculoskeletal exercise resistance work is as important as a cardiovascular health.
Yeah, so that is something that recently was updated in our cardiology guidelines, was specifically to address not just aerobic exercise that we already discussed, but that isometric exercises, resistance training is something that we should also be promoting because there are benefits to doing that as well. So doing several days a week of resistance training or isometric exercises can have a comparable cardiovascular benefit. In addition, it has been shown that those types of exercises have a similar effect, for example, on lowering your blood pressure. So doing some sort of resistance training, isometric exercises, weight training, has beneficial effects from a cardiovascular standpoint.
And then looking at the diet that you would instruct a patient to take a look at? What's your favorite diet?
So this, I think, area like opens a lot of can of worms. You know, there are a lot of people who are very interested in finding what is that really healthy diet, what is going to help prevent people from developing heart disease. And the reality is that the types of studies to try to evaluate diets are very difficult to conduct. To control for the many variables, to ensure that individuals are adhering to the specific diets that are recommended is challenging. However, the diet that I am a strong proponent of, based on the best science that we have, is the Mediterranean diet. So I think what makes it difficult to adhere to a Mediterranean diet is that there are no specific recommendations on how much of certain types of foods to eat. So it's more generalized recommendations about the things that you should incorporate into your diet. So a Mediterranean diet usually consists of using olive oil as opposed to other more saturated fatty oils like coconut oil or even some vegetable oils. It incorporates more fish, so fatty fishes like salmon, halibut, and to reduce the amount of saturated fats from red meat. And then it emphasizes whole grains, lots of beans, legumes, and those types of fruits and vegetables, because in this diet we have found that when we compare it to what we describe as a traditional low saturated fat diet that we have been promoting for many years, there seem to be lower rates of heart attacks and cardiovascular events for people who have been adhering to this Mediterranean style diet versus a traditional low saturated fat diet.
I'm in agreement. The research over the years that I've looked into men's health, the Mediterranean diet seems to outperform all other diets. That said, any diet is better than no diet. And I do promote the Mediterranean, though. It's actually the most healthy and not that difficult to follow. The reason that people stay on the Mediterranean is because it's good food, and people like eating the result of the Mediterranean diet.
I agree. I think, you know, the real challenge is, from my perspective, is that, for example, a discussion I had with a patient today who's had a recent heart attack and has had multiple stents is that he doesn't like fish. And so fish is a major component, at least from the source of your fat intake. And so that has been a challenge for some people. But overall, you know, that diet is not as difficult to adhere to. I think the real challenge is that people like eating red meat and pork, and to try to reduce their intake of that is probably the biggest challenge.
So while we were on the topic momentarily of fish, fish oil as far as prevention.
So that's a great question. So this certainly is an area of avid interest from a research standpoint. I think, you know, a recent clinical trial was just published about 2 months ago that looked at 4 grams of omega-3 fatty acids, so marine-based fish oil. And so this particular specific omega-3 fatty acid or is called EPA, or eicosapentaenoic acid, and it was studied in a population of people who had had a heart attack or stroke and showed surprisingly positive results. So in this trial of many thousands of patients who were given high doses of purified EPA or omega-3 fatty acids had about a 25% lower risk of cardiovascular events. And so it's the first large randomized trial that showed a clear benefit in a very high-risk population of those who've had heart attacks or strokes. I think what is less clear is how much benefit do we get in the general population, let's say a young man or a 70-year-old individual who's never had a heart attack, whether they benefit from fish oil or not is unclear.
So in the current presentation of the ability to do monitoring and to look for information, let's first look at some available information that the population can go to, that you would recommend, look, I'm going to give you some resources that you can go online and plug in your numbers and see if you're at risk. So if you want to go through a couple of those for us.
Absolutely. So the American College of Cardiology is the international organization that I belong to that represents over 55,000 cardiovascular specialists worldwide. So the organization is responsible for creating guidelines and standards for management and evaluation of the major cardiovascular risk factors as well as those who have underlying heart disease. So a risk calculator was created a few years ago. So the American College of Cardiology has a website called acc.org where you can find these tools that allow you, for example, to calculate your cardiovascular risk. And so I use this actually for all of my patients. There's a smartphone app that you can download to your smartphone that will allow you to plug in your number. So you plug in your age, your gender, your race, your blood pressure, your cholesterol levels, as well as if you have a history of diabetes, high blood pressure, whether you're taking aspirin or cholesterol-lowering medications, and whether you have a history of smoking. And when you plug in that information, it will spit out a score, which essentially is telling you what your estimated risk is of having a cardiovascular event in the next 10 years. And so this is what we use to help decide where somebody's risk is and whether an intervention needs to be made, such as whether we need to start taking cholesterol-lowering medication or whether somebody needs to be started on blood pressure medication based on their risk. So this is the tool that we have adopted in the United States. Cardiologists use it, and primary care providers uniformly use this particular risk calculator.
Are there any others that you favor, or just this is the main one that you would tell people to start with?
I think this is the main one that I would advocate that people start with. There are a whole variety of other tools that exist that are not necessarily applicable to our population. The Europeans have their own score system, which they use, which probably is not necessarily an accurate reflection of our demographics. So that's probably not the right risk calculator. So I think that this is a very reasonable starting point. I think once you get this information, then you can discuss this with your provider, who can share additional tools that might be useful to do some additional refinement of your risk.
And speaking of tools, we now have a lot of technology available. The Apple Watch, AliveCore. Mm-hmm. These are devices that you can pair to your smartphone and help you understand perhaps even your cardiac rhythm. You can capture your heart rate. Fitbits can tell you if you're exercising and how long and how much and how many steps. Mm-hmm. Do you like these for patients?
You know, I think, you know, in the cardiology community, there's probably a bit of a mixed response. I think one issue is that, you know, there's sort of data overload from all the information that can be collected now. Two is the noise that's associated with the data. So, you know, unfortunately, the accuracy of some of the information that we acquire from these devices is not always good information or good data. So sometimes we get lots of false positive data. However, I think the key thing is that when people use these tools, it's at least an indicator that they're interested in their health and they want to try to improve their health by using these devices to monitor their physical activity levels, and in some cases, you know, to assess whether they have some abnormal heart rhythm. There are now devices being developed to measure blood pressure using a wristwatch device. So we are getting to an age where these devices are going to be valuable to help us detect problems sometimes earlier than what we currently are able to do without having the patient come and see us in the office.
And let's take now a patient who's more at risk, and they come to you as a cardiologist, and they're a little apprehensive about what they might encounter. So generally, what sort of screening things do you do that you look at that are not so invasive that you can offer a patient?
So I think you're right. Anybody who comes to see a cardiologist usually is afraid that there's something seriously wrong with them and that we're going to poke and prod their body and do all sorts of tests on them. And I can say that, you know, as a preventative cardiologist, that, and just in the field of cardiology in general, because there's recognition of people being worried about the risks of doing invasive procedures, we've moved away a lot from doing that up front, and we have a lot of tools that we can use to assess risks that are non-invasive tests. So in general, if we need to do some assessment of somebody's risk, we can do stress tests where people walk on a treadmill. Sometimes we do an ultrasound. So those are relatively not very harmful interventions or tests that we do. We can also do CAT scans where we image people's hearts, and we can actually use that as a way to diagnose heart disease as well as for risk stratification. So lots of movement in cardiology is now to do testing that does not require sort of invasive procedures, because the data shows that many of these non-invasive tests are very good at screening people for heart disease.
And your interventions aren't just aimed at coronary disease, but people who have arrhythmias, and their ability now in this day and age to help patients who have had in what maybe days in the past couldn't be treated. You now have interventions to help arrhythmias, you have medications, you have ability to keep people's risk factors lower, and if they have to go to actually interventions, you do have that in the form of catheterizations and stents and keeping people alive.
Absolutely. So the focus on treatment of heart disease has been to really try to exhaust all of our non-invasive or non-interventional options as much as we can, whether it's from an arrhythmia or whether people have coronary artery disease and blockages of the arteries. The current sort of culture and the current sort of wisdom is that medical therapy is as effective as invasive procedures, and that we should really reserve those procedures for those who have exhausted all of their medical options or who have sort of experienced side effects, which makes it difficult for them to take medications. So in general, our focus is on aggressive medical intervention, lifestyle changes, behavioral modification, and only go to those invasive procedures when absolutely necessary.
And then to promote a continued sort of evolution of health. Okay, I've got my weight down, I'm exercising. Whether or not I need fish oil is based on some factors that my doctor would tell me. Should I take an aspirin a day? Would you put it in the water if you could, or is it selected?
So I think, unfortunately, like many of the things I've already talked about, there's a lot of controversy. Aspirin has been studied in several clinical trials that were published about 5 months ago and raised a lot of questions about the benefit of aspirin for primary prevention of cardiovascular disease. So this is an area of uncertainty. For patients who have no heart disease or vascular problems, at this point, there may not be a benefit to taking aspirin. That's something that ultimately you should consult with your provider about before making a decision to unilaterally not take aspirin for prevention. But what we have learned in the last few years is that the conventional wisdom that aspirin in adult males and females having a cardiovascular benefit does not seem to have been sustained in the studies that have been conducted in the last few years.
And I know that listeners are going to be questioning alcohol use, and I know it's a complex subject of how much, whether it's okay or not, and this may just be opinion because I think there's evolving data. But let's take the young, healthy man. Would you tell him don't drink, or always just drink in moderation if he wants to?
So I think, again, another area where we have a lot of controversy. At least there's more consistency in the data. You know, although there are some studies that have raised some concerns about any alcohol consumption, the majority of the studies that have been published in the last decade have really shown relatively good consistency that for a man, consuming on average 2 drinks a day or less has a potential cardiovascular benefit. For a woman, it's about 1 drink a day. And exceeding that for a man or woman is associated with greater cardiovascular risk. And drinking not at all, it seems to also have some higher cardiovascular risk. However, that doesn't mean that I recommend that somebody who's never had anything to drink to start drinking again, because that's probably not something that I would advocate. But moderation of alcohol consumption is reasonable. Where we have some problems is binge drinking, so that's probably a more serious concern. So when you have more than 4 or 5 drinks in an hour, that is associated with increased cardiovascular morbidity and mortality. So binge drinking is probably less healthy than just consuming alcohol, like on a sort of moderate level on a consistent basis.
So to summarize, keys to cardiovascular health are to control weight with appropriate weight, and we didn't really get into BMI, but your primary care doctor can advise. Know your risk factors. Use one of these calculators. If you are at risk, make certain that you get in and get checked. And you can start with your primary and then be referred to cardiology as necessary. We would look at the non-smoking as a cornerstone of continued good health. Not smoking is essential in so many organs and disease processes, and then to be aware if you have risk factors or if you actually have cardiac issues, don't ignore them. Get help, get checked. Anything else?
No, I think you summarized everything quite well.
Well, I truly appreciate it. Thank you. And it's always good speaking with you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Feldman.
This completes another podcast chapter of the Washington State Urology Society's original Guide to Men's Health. This is Dr. Richard Feldman reminding you to take care of yourself. The Washington State Urology Society wishes to thank all contributors who volunteered their time and knowledge. The information presented is the opinion of the speakers. The Society also wishes to thank Sean Fox for his invaluable technical assistance. Music theme, San Juan Bells, written and performed by Dr. Dave Weidig. The podcasts are the property of the Washington State Urology Society. Reproduction and use without the express consent of the Society is strictly prohibited. For more information about men's health, visit wsus.org or visit your physician or care provider.